So I'll begin this session on God the Creator by taking you back to what we did about a month ago. It's, as I said, it's from our attempt to make sense of creation, of our experience of creation, including our own selves, that the very notion of God arises. Everything we experience, this is a summary of something done at greater length earlier, everything we experience is, to use the technical word, contingent. It exists in fact, like we exist in fact, but it cannot on its own provide sufficient explanation for this fact. We have to look beyond the existent reality to account for its existence. And since everywhere we look for meaning, everything we bring in correctly as a part answer to that question, why, not why did you come to be, but why do I actually exist? Since everything I come to is itself contingent, the logic of the argument is that there must exist now a being that is self-sufficient and self-explanatory to ground the contingent reality that's all around us. Being Aristotle talks about this, he calls it the uncaused cause, and our name for it in our language is God. The world couldn't exist if there did not exist a non-contingent being holding everything in existence, the being that we call God. I'm sure these arguments should take place in that little brief summary, but that's what I'm presenting to you. It's in God that we, to quote Luke, who's actually quoting, I think it's Epimenides, one of the Cretan philosophers, we live and move and have our being. It's wonderfully big stuff we're talking about there. So, something that we've done before on different occasions, but I want to do it again with you, is the word God, because why do we choose this word to talk about this self-sufficient reality that holds everything in existence? Why do we call it God? Well, the oldest extant language cognate to English in the Indo-European languages is Sanskrit. And in Sanskrit, the hard G sound, from which we get God, G, the G, means called or calling. It's the verb to call. And the T at the end, got, G-O-T-T in German, or God, the D in English, got is the one. So the word God, if you take it right back to the woodwork, get rid of all the paint, and get right back to the, because every word has an image under it, the image is of calling. Either God is the one we are calling when we're in agony or ecstasy or joy, or ultimately our being is calling out to everything but to God. Or, on the other hand, God is the one who's calling us. Vocation, we use the word from the Latin. So God is calling us. There's a calling going on. There's a In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was towards God, and the Word was God. The whole creation is the Word, of course, and it's all there, a gravity of grace drawing the whole of creation to God and being held in existence by this God. Teilhard de Chardin, years ago, I read this, 60 years ago probably now, but I've never read anything better, so I give it to you. He talks about God as the heart and the beyond of everything. Heart meaning centre, core. The heart of everything and the beyond of everything. His point is very beautiful. It means that the closer you get to the heart of anything, any mystery that you're examining, any person, the closer we get to the heart, the more we're in touch with mystery, something that just is beyond. We don't get in touch with a heart to clinch a thing and hold it and understand it and comprehend it and lock it in. As we get to the heart of anything, we find ourselves taken into. And the great scientists know this. Einstein among them, or one of the earliest of this, he was aware of the mystery of creation. And the closer science takes us to the very heart of what light is, which we haven't got to yet, and we're still searching, the closer we get to that, the more we realise how beyond our comprehension this extraordinary universe is. Well, God is the heart of everything, but the beyond as well. In technical terms, God is immanent and transcendent. The being of every creature is an expression of the being that is God. This is the logic of what I'm saying. You, each of you, is a unique expression of God. When your latest grandchild comes into the world, your image of God necessarily changes, because you've had an experience. Here's another aspect of God that the world had never seen before. And with this whole universe that's emerging for us, that's what's happening. God is being re-expressed. We're held in existence in order that we may enjoy divine intimacy. That's the whole purpose of our life. In the book of Proverbs, wisdom personified exclaims, this is chapter 8, verse 30, I was daily the delight of Yahweh. All was rejoicing in Yahweh's presence, rejoicing in God's inhabited world and delighting in the human race. A statement from Teilhard de Chardin, his Divine Milieu. He says, see if this is true for you, I think it will be. By means of all created things, the divine assails us, penetrates us, molds us. We imagine the divine as distant and inaccessible, whereas we live steeped in its burning layers. In him we live. As Jacob said, going back to what you were saying, Maureen, I think, very close to what you were saying, awakening from his dream, the world, this palpable world, which we are wont to treat with the boredom and disrespect with which we habitually regard places with no sacred association for us, is in truth a holy place. And we didn't know it. You know the story of Jacob on the rock, and he had this dream of the ladder going to heaven, and he said, this was a sacred place and I didn't really know it. Well, everything's a sacred place. The whole world is sacred because God is at the heart of everything. So if we treated the whole world and every particular person and myself, each of ourselves, to realise what a holy place we are, that awareness would surely do what Paul says to his community who weren't living very holy lives in Corinth. He's saying, live by who you are. This is who you are, live it. Well, with that introduction, which is meant to be a summary in a way of two or three weeks of work, we now move to the image of God the Creator. In the ancient Near Eastern world, there are a number of ways of imagining creation. The first is generation from the gods. You may or may not have read Hesiod's Theogony. Well, if you read, and you can read it in half an hour, Hesiod was about the 7th or 8th century BC, about the same time as Homer, that period. And he's written a whole book on the Theogony, and that tells you how Hera and Athene and, God, there's dozens of them, all these gods, how they're all related to each other. And how Zeus comes in there, he's the son, actually, of Kronos. And Kronos, you know, so you've got all this gods begetting gods, the way we beget people. Well, that image is never found in the writings of Israel, which doesn't surprise you. But it's one of the images of the ancient world that they lived in. But they rejected it because there's only one God for them, and God doesn't beget gods. A second image, which occurs regularly in the ancient texts, is this creation is the result of a struggle between God and the forces of chaos. You may have heard of Tiamat, Apsu, fresh water, salt water, struggling, and then out of them comes creation, which is drops of blood from the one that gets defeated, and so it goes on and on and on. The Bible actually uses this imagery quite poetically and quite powerfully. It's only an image, of course. It's a metaphor. I'll read it to you. Isaiah 51:9. Awake, awake, clothe yourself with strength, O arm of Yahweh. Awake as in days gone by, as in generations of old. Was it not you who cut Rahab in pieces, who pierced the monster through? Well, that image comes from the ancient texts, the Sumerian texts. Now, a distraction on fundamentalism. No one in this room can be in the slightest doubt that that's imagery, isn't it? Poetic imagery. So what does that do to fundamentalism as a point of view? It makes it look so stupid. Can God only inspire facts? No. Can't God inspire drama and poetry and myth and epic and a whole range of human ways of trying to express insight? Can all be coming from an experience of the divine? Of course. So when we read the Bible, we've got to be so Shakespearean. We've got to be so caught up in that drama and poetry and all of that to read it intelligently and not take it all as true meaning fact. True meaning, a profound insight into reality, is what we should be looking for. Here again, here's Psalm 74. It was you who split open the sea by your power. You broke the heads of the monsters in the waters. It was you who crushed the heads of Leviathan, gave him as food to the creatures of the desert. You may or may not enjoy that dramatic poetry, but the Bible enjoyed it. And you find absolutely identical statements or equivalent statements in all the ancient world. So they are part of their world, so they're using the language of their world to communicate the power of God, clearly in metaphor. A third image, getting closer to us really, is of God is like a potter working clay, which was their world. Here's Genesis chapter 2, verse 7. Yahweh God shaped humanity, and the Hebrew word for humanity is Adam. He's not talking about Adam, a bloke. He's talking about humanity. God shaped humanity from the dust of the soil. How interesting. Adam comes from Adama. You're right. That's why they've used the word. Adama means the soil. Adam is the one that comes from it. Just drop the A-H off the end and you've got it. But that's not enough for us human beings. The poetry again of Genesis. God took this stuff and moulded it. But that wasn't alive. He breathed into the nostrils of humanity the breath of life. And the human being became a living being. And living includes life-giving being. Isaiah 64, Yahweh, you are our maker. We're the clay. You're the potter. We're all the work of your hand. Job, lovely poet, the writer of Job, remember that you moulded me like clay. Will you turn me back to dust? Did you not pour me out like milk and curdle me like cheese, clothe me with skin and flesh and knit me together with bones and sinews? That was their best way of understanding what was going on inside the womb. You gave me life, you showed me kindness. And in your providence, you watched over my breath, my life breath. And Job again. He spreads out the northern skies over empty space. He suspends the earth over nothing. He wraps up the waters in the clouds, yet the clouds do not burst under their weight. He covers the face of the full moon, spreading his clouds over it. He marks out the horizon on the face of the waters for a boundary between light and darkness. The pillars of the heavens quake, aghast at his rebuke. By his power he churned up the sea. By his wisdom he cut Rahab to pieces. By his breath the skies became fair. His hand pierced the gliding serpent. And these about the outer fringe of his works, how faint the whisper we hear of him. Who then can understand the thunder of his power? And fourthly and finally, as an image, the book of Genesis is the purest of them all, because in the book of Genesis, God creates simply by his word, meaning by his will. No pottering, no slaying of beasts, no begetting of gods. This is just God wanted it, so it is. You know the book of Genesis, of course, at the end of each day, and God said, let there be light, and light was, and God said, etc. In the inspired poem offered us in the opening chapter of the book of Genesis, and pause, there are people who think the book of Genesis is a factual description of creation. Well, the only way around that is to get them to read a bit of poetry. Try to help them just break open this fixation on fact, as though there's nothing more important than fact. It's very important facts, but there are deeper things than that. It's God's power that is highlighted here. God creates simply by his word. In this way, the author carefully preserves the transcendence of God, who creates by the power of his will, because imagining God as a potter is clearly totally inadequate, because God hasn't got hands and he isn't mucking around with clay. This is the transcendent God. God speaks and it's done. The Genesis narrative focuses on the power of God, on God's basic goodness, and the basic goodness of creation. And God saw that it was good, remember, after each day. And then finally, when God comes to the perfection of his creation, which is human beings, God saw that creation was very good. So Genesis is showing us how beautiful this world is as it comes from God. Then it has to cope with something that we'll do next week. Why is it so unlovely? It is lovely, but why the unlovely bits? And that'll take us into the human response to God, which we call sin. Now we come to the God of Israel. I keep spelling it in my writings just with the four capital letters. That's in respect to the Jewish. They're the English equivalents of that word there. That's the Hebrew, Yahweh. Sometimes it's translated the Lord. So here's a text from Exodus. God calls Moses to be his instrument in redeeming the Hebrew slaves from Egypt. That's a summary. And he assures Moses in Exodus 3:12, he says, I will be with you. And I put in brackets there in English lettering, the Hebrew Eye. That's the Hebrew if you want to see what it looks like, reading from right to left. But they're the English letters, Eye. Eye means, in that text, I will be. It's the ordinary verb to be, future. Eye. Now, a little bit later, still in that chapter 3, Moses asks God God's name. And the answer given by God is here, Exodus 3:14, Eye, Asher, Eye. Often translated, I am what I am. But you've already seen that Eye can mean I will be. There's no distinction in the Hebrew. You have to tell from the context. So you could quite absolutely translate that, I will be who I will be. Which I think is actually closer to the feeling of that text. Moses, in the story, wants to name God, which means pigeonhole God, which means identify God, put a little tag on God. So he's got God organized, and then there's this, and there's some. You can't do that with God, because God's at the heart of everything. So God is actually equivalently saying to Moses, look, don't you worry about my name. You can't name me. I'll be who I'll be. Just you walk, and I will be with you. I will be with you. I will walk with you. You'll discover me. You'll experience me. I will be with you in your journey. So don't try and name me. Walk with me and let me walk with you. And then he says, chapter 3, verse 14, you'll say to the Israelites, I am Eyeh, or I will be, has sent me to you. And then for the first time in their language appears this word Yahweh. Yahweh has sent me to you. So the word Yahweh, here, the Hebrew, it's a unique word. It's not used anywhere else except in relation to God. But it clearly comes from the verb to be somewhere. It's a made-up word from there. And how's it translated? Well, in the Jerusalem Bible, in the New American Bible, the New International Version, the NRSV, the Revised English Bible, and in the Jewish Publication Society Bible, they all translate it Lord. If you go to the Jerusalem Bible, which is still the one we use in our church, and the New Jerusalem Bible, they translate it Yahweh. You might, well, I avoid all that by just using the four letters here. And whenever you see the word Yahweh or the Lord in your Bible, you're meant to think of this scene. God who's come to redeem his people. So you might like to translate it our saving God or our redeeming God, because the word is never used without the idea of Moses going to redeem the people, or God redeeming the people via Moses from Egypt. So it's always about liberation, freedom, redemption. How you translate it, it's up to you. In the Catechism, number 203, it says, to disclose one's name is to make oneself known to others. We know that. In a way, it's to hand oneself over by becoming accessible, capable of being known more intimately and addressed personally. A good statement, I think, but it's problematic a little bit because we don't name God. We did enough of that about 3 weeks ago, and all those, the mystics and all the early fathers of the church, Justin Martyr and all these, said, if you think you've got God, well, you're wrong. You haven't got God. You've got something else. So we're talking about a reality which is beyond everything we can comprehend, at the heart of everything, the most real of anything we'll ever experience, but unable to be named, because every name keeps falling short of the reality. The Jewish God, what is this Jewish God like? Well, a million things one could say, and I won't. I'll take it as known. But I'll take you to the creed. It's kind of a creed, because it appears, well, in all these texts, there it is, the classical one in Exodus, but here it is in Joel, Jonah, Nehemiah, Chronicles, Psalms. So it appears regularly, and I'll read it to you. Yahweh, a God tenderly compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in kindness. If you asked a Jew, what do you really think of God? That would have to be the answer. Of course, it's complicated by all the other images that come in and upset it and get in the road and add to it and so on. But that's the key creed of the Jewish faith. A God who's tenderly compassionate, rahamim, and gracious. Gracious meaning giving gifts, gifting. Slow to anger. So God is angry, gets angry in the Old Testament scriptures, is angry. In other words, God hates sin and is angered by it, but very slow to do it, very patient. Only when we're absolutely determined, obstinately to continue in it, does God then burst a boiler and destroy Sodom or Gomorrah. Remember that lovely story we had recently about Abraham saying, look, if there were 40 just men and 50, 45, 40, and got right down to 10, but they couldn't get any lower. So what does it mean to come? We've covered this a little bit, but I want to do it again with you. And this will take a little bit of time. When we say God is almighty, what are we saying? It's a notion, I suggest, that needs careful handling. We suggested that one of the basic misunderstandings about God, I've done this with you already, is found throughout the Old Testament, that God is thought of as controlling creation. Such that, and this is regularly throughout the Old Testament, happenings that are judged to be good are seen as an expression of God's blessing. Happenings that are judged to be bad are seen as an expression of God's disapproval or punishment. So, if a couple are childless, God is punishing them because of what their parents did or their grandparents. They must have done something wrong because that is a sign of punishment. If they have plenty of children and there's plenty of food around to feed them, then God is blessing them. And if they've got seven sons, well, then they're really made. Seven being the perfect number, etc., etc. Anyone here with seven sons, put your hand up. But anyhow, okay. Well, that's not good. That's to be seven. So, you understand all that there from the Old Testament, don't you? And remember in the New Testament, remember the man born blind? And they came up to him and they said, look, Jesus, who sinned? Did he sin or his parents that he was born blind? So the mentality was alive and well during the time of Jesus. It's still alive and well, unfortunately, in spite of Jesus today. Now, the basis for this misunderstanding is our understanding of power. God is almighty. In our experience, power is often abused. It's often expressed as control. When we call God almighty, declaring our faith that there are no limits to God's power, it's essential that we remember that God is love. That the power of God is the power of love. It's God's love power that has no limits. So we can't use power to contradict what we know God to be, love, and therefore twist up who God is. God is love, and the love is without limit. But it doesn't take over. Examine your own conscience. When, as adults, we experience someone attempting to control us, think how you feel when someone's trying to control you. We don't experience this as love. While love is demanding and is willing to challenge and correct, it never controls. It doesn't take over the reins. It doesn't grab and organise your life. It respects your freedom. Love respects others as sacred and respects their freedom. Love does not, cannot protect us from suffering the consequences of our misuse or abuse of freedom. What love does is it loves. It does not control. The idea of a controlling God is so embodied in our psyche that we have to be determined if we're to listen attentively to Jesus and watch him reveal God as precisely not controlling. It is a big shift still for many people. Jesus, when he looked at Jerusalem and it was making a mess of things, you know the story, he didn't go in and clean it up. He wept. If only you'd listened, you know, I would have taken you as a hen gathers her chickens under her wing, but you wouldn't listen. And because you didn't listen, look what's going to happen. The city's going to be destroyed. The temple's going to be burnt down. Anyone could see that with any brains. Jesus could see it happening because they were determined to continue their petty, power-hungry determination to control. Jesus pleaded with Judas in the garden. Why are you doing this, Judas? Judas is doing it. Jesus is not going to stop him doing it because God isn't about stopping us doing anything. He's trying to love us out of it, so freely we won't do it. But he hugs him and says, friend, why do you betray me with a kiss? Why are you doing this? It's not that God is doing nothing. God loves. The best thing anyone can ever do. God is inspiring us to all to love and offering us the grace to do it. God, the Creator, enables us to co-create, that is, to love, to bring alive others. This is the love of which Paul speaks when he says in his lovely hymn in Corinthians, he ends by saying, love has space enough to hold and bear everything and everyone. Love believes all things, hopes all things, endures whatever comes. Love does not come to an end. Now I hope that all of you in your own way will be able to put a face on someone who's like that in you, has been like that in your life. It's probably a grandfather or grandmother, probably, who've got beyond all the necessity of controlling little kids, because you'd have to control little kids because they're not capable of, you have to nurture the little plant and protect it. But ultimately it's all in view of it growing into a sturdy, free adult, creative adult. But so hopefully you know someone who's been like that for you. And hopefully we'll be like that for others. Now, is this true? I'm just giving you my best thoughts on it, and they may not be true. Not only am I free and you are free, within limits, of course, because our environment necessarily clips our wings a bit. We're not totally free, but we've got freedom. I think the whole of creation is essentially free. The word will have to be used a little bit analogically. It's free to evolve according to the natural interaction of its energies. God, the history of our planet, extraordinary. And it's still going on with earthquakes and seismic stuff and the plates of the earth and all that. God doesn't intervene to cut across this. He doesn't stop the expanding of the and movement of the plates of the earth. God is constantly acting in creation, and when creation opens itself to God's action, beautiful things happen. When creation closes itself off from God's loving action, God's design in that sense is thwarted, or rather, God's will isn't done in the short term, because I'm not doing his will. I'm resisting the will of God. This does involve an idea of miracles, I admit, and I don't want to talk about it now, though you may want to next week. I find it hard to fit into my mind what I used to think about miracles and what the church still looks for example, in beatification and canonization. Our present pope has decided, well, one's enough for John the 23rd, so, and good on him. And the next pope will decide you don't need any, really, because it's their sanctity that's the miracle. It's the beauty of life that's palpable and outstanding. We don't need to have something happening in creation that you can't yet explain and then say God did it because he wants us to canonise the pope. Well, if God wants to do something extraordinary in our world so that we'll canonise Pope Pius X, for example. If you've read any of the history of the papacy, you might wonder about that. It's not up to me to wonder about, especially not on tape. But, I mean, whatever about all that is, well, why doesn't God do wonderful things in the world to feed the starving? And to, there's a whole lot of other things that should be happening until we realise that, hang on, God is loving the world. So love is the most powerful thing in the world, but it's ultimately not powerful in the sense of organising or controlling it. Love is suffering. You know, you think of people you love that won't accept your love, or think of when your love was misunderstood, or think of, there's plenty we can all think of. And it's pain. Love is very painful. But the alternative to not having the pain of love, the chagrin d'amour, is to be like a rock. I am a rock, I'm an island, as we used to sing in the 70s. Miracles are, as I understand it, miracles happen all the time. Absolutely wonderful things are happening in everybody's life, all over the world, all the time. And if miracles are what God is doing, then miracles happen when love holds sway. And where love enters, anything's possible. Anything's possible. It may not cure, it may not make me grow a leg if I've lost a leg, but if love comes in, take love out of your life and realise how sick you'd be, how we'd all be. So, I mean, we couldn't survive without love. So love is so important. Well, that if love came into people's lives at the time of Jesus in such an extraordinary way, I'm not surprised that people found healing and sight and life and movement, and, you know, but it's always expressed dramatically in the scriptural texts. I don't think you need an action outside the laws of nature. The most natural thing around is love. And I think love is the healer and the miracle worker. We human beings experience this, and when we open ourselves to welcome God's providence, divine love bears fruit in our lives. Closing ourselves to God's gracious will is what we call sin. God respects our freedom even when our choices hurt us and hurt others. But God continues to offer healing, forgiving, and creative love. I remember looking at, just came to my mind then, the Stations of the Cross, created by Hans Urs von Balthasar, who was a theologian some 50 years ago. And he's got the one of the last stations is Jesus on the cross, and I'm there, or you're there, and we're looking up at him, and he's looking up to God. And we're saying, my God, why have you abandoned me? That's our cry. And he added, let that be God's question to you. It's quite powerful. God hasn't abandoned anyone. Why have you abandoned me? Why are you not open to the mystery of love? In other words, we're the ones that have to break free and let love break us free, whatever the cost. Here's a text from Peter, quoted in the Catechism. Cast all your anxieties on God, for God cares about you. 1 Peter 5:7. Or Romans 8:28. We know that everything God works for good for those who love him. Down the centuries, Christians, and not only in the past, have blunted and distorted Jesus' revelation. In a half-converted way, we've overlain Jesus' words and deeds with our own prejudices and our own projections. Some still want God to intervene when what we should be doing is opening ourselves to love, helping others to do the same. If we were to do this, think of the miracles that would happen in our world, miracles that only love can make possible. Jesus revealed God as love, and God's love is all powerful. The only miracles that happen, now this may be overstated, the only miracles that happen are miracles that happen when love is not thwarted. We can pray like a child for whatever we desire, so long as we open ourselves to love and allow love to work its purifying and energizing effect in us and in our world. Jesus said once, ask and you will receive. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened to you. And then he could see the puzzled look on everybody's face because they'd sought and hadn't found and they'd knocked and the door didn't open and all the rest of it. And then he sees that and says, oh, hang on. He says, come on, you people. What father among you, he said, with a little child in their arms, you know, and the little child asks for bread, would give the child a stone? I think the image is bread roll, little white round thing. And the little baby is going, it's pointing to, it wants bread. So it's pointing to this little thing that it thinks is food to put in its mouth, but it's actually pointing to a stone because it hasn't got the discernment to pick the difference. And he said, what father of you would be that stupid that you'd say, oh, little kid's pointing to a stone, I better give it the stone. And the kid puts the stone in and swallows the bloody thing and chokes. No, he said, you'd give it bread because you know what it really wants. The child doesn't know. And the child looks to a egg on a plate, especially one I made, and it's a fried egg and it looks like a bloody scorpion so because it's all splattered everywhere. Well, the little kid thinks that is an egg and it goes, giddy, giddy, and dad's not that stupid to give it a scorpion. It'll say, oh, look, poor little thing, so it distracts it, bashes the scorpion off the table, puts an egg there and gives it the egg and everybody's happy. In other words, when I pray, I don't know what to pray for, and God says, just pray for anything, forget about it, go for it. But at the end of your prayer, say, not my will, but thine be done. Like, trust lovingly that the Father actually will give you what you need. Or as Jesus says, give you the Holy Spirit to those who ask. And to conclude this first half, we have every hope that beyond death and beyond suffering, there's the promise of an eternity of love communion that is for us, provided we don't obstinately reject it. God embraced Jesus from the cross into an eternal love communion, and our hope is that God will embrace us also. So that's my best effort to do God the Creator. After the break, I'll look at God as Father. Yeah.